Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to another Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, of course, Chris Martinson, and this week we welcome Dave Collum to the podcast. Now, for those of you unfamiliar with Dave, he is professor of chemistry and chemical biology at Cornell University, the place I got my MBA from. And in addition to his academic interest, Dave authors an annual macroeconomic assessment titled Year in Review. And he is hands down the best synopsis of everything that mattered during the previous 12 months. If you want to read it, it's at the site. You can find it at Zero Hedge. It's around there. It's a great synopsis. We're going to discuss that today. And Dave's latest year in review really touched on some things that I'm very anxious to talk about. So I'm excited to have him here with us now live. And Dave, thank you so much for joining us again this year.
Hey, I'm thrilled to be here. We had a podcast about 2 years ago that was my favorite of all recorded events that I've ever done. And so I jumped at this opportunity.
Well, then we should make it an annual occurrence at least. So you know where I want to start? Okay, so one of the things that I'm most struck by in reading your 2012 review, all of this compressed into a single document, is just how far off the track we seem to be. Markets are structurally broken by allowing computer-driven trading strategies on one end of the spectrum, while the truly powerful institutions, and in some cases individuals, are allowed to get away with blatant thefts, felonies, other assorted misdemeanors and malfeasances. So here's a question. Is this just how things have always been, but are now being exposed by macroeconomic weakness, you know, Buffett's famous tide going out, or are these things actually getting worse? You've been tracking this year after year. What do you think?
Well, you know, I think it's a little of everything you mentioned. There's no question that we have access to this information now that we didn't used to have. So, you know, the Internet is this phenomenally democratic device. I used to hear people say that it was sort of the greatest thing since Gutenberg, and I was dismissive of that as hyperbole, and the more I thought about it, the more I tend to agree with that, because I can reach out to people that were unimaginably distant from me in the past. So government, as it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, even a fixed level of corruption will get, by definition, bigger, and so I think that's a problem. I draw an analogy in the review about global warming and monetary policy, and you know, the global warming debate is one of where if we are heating the planet, what we not only get is a higher temperature, but we also get, which would be analogous to, say, inflation, but we also get a increased volatility. We get more turbulent weather, sandy-like events, and I think that happens in the markets themselves, and I think it also happens in the corruption that you get. So as, you know, as trillions move around the planet, the crime syndicates are going to go straight for that money. I mean, there's no money to be made in the little stuff when you can make so much money based on, you know, Federal Reserve and central banking largesse. So I think it's gotten massively problematic.
Well, what's interesting to me is, you know, to pick a couple of cases, and one that you did highlight, the case of MF Global, and in particular to name an individual, John Corzine, he appears to have been allowed to get away with what occurs to me to just be blatant theft. And the thing that just absolutely drives me nuts in this story is this storyline that they immediately came out with, that the money vaporized. Like somehow money can just go away. Like, oops, we can't track it. And you and I both know that everything is tracked. And if money could just randomly appear and disappear, the Russian mafia would have figured that out long ago and just started you know, what's the opposite of vaporizing? You know, depositing money out of nowhere into accounts. It doesn't happen. How are they getting away with pushing that storyline that it just disappeared?
Well, that particular story, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal, that got denounced by a lot of people. That drew scorn very quickly. It was certainly a planted story, right? That was mm-hmm. That was an attempt to front run it and try to come up with some storyline that people would accept as, oh, the money's no longer traceable. That's just nuts, right?
Right.
My advice to them is they should get a computer or two, because that would allow them to track it. And then afterwards, as they start sort of entangling the mess that this MF Global created, and you get these trustees, there's a guy named Giddens and then Louis Fries in there, and they start negotiating with the depositors who were the ones who got hosed in this deal, you discover that the money really does exist, and what these guys are negotiating is that if the depositors agree to take their money back, which means therefore it wasn't vaporized, they also have to agree to not press charges, which means that, you know, theft is not theft if you give the money back. It would be a nice system for the bank robbers, because they get caught, they turn it back in, and then all's forgiven, right? And that's what MF Global did. Corzine is a particularly problematic case, because Corzine, while being investigated, was bundling funds for Obama, and Obama's Justice Department, therefore, was in a terrible conflict. Mm. And they should have shut down the bundling in the very least for just the optics, but they didn't. And so in the end, they dropped the charges against Corzine. They never gave immunity to his second in command, which would, you know, if you get immunity, you not only can't be charged, but you're forced to testify. You can't plead the fifth. And so if they'd taken a second in command and said, now, here you get immunity, now spill your guts, Corzine would be in jail now, I think. That's my guess. And we certainly would know what happened, but they don't want Corzine. He's too connected.
Well, this is an interesting sort of a theme that if you're connected enough, some sort of a story is made up. And what just came out recently was this whole story around HSBC. Now, they got caught laundering billions and billions and billions of dollars for drug cartels. And you and I know that as a private citizen, if you're just driving down the road and you get pulled over and you happen to have cash in your car, no matter how much you can prove it's yours, the police can still seize it and hold it and, you know, force you to prove that it's not illegal. And even in some cases, that isn't sufficient with some test cases we have out there. But HSBC gets just absolutely nailed, and the Justice Department swoops in and declines to press any criminal charges because I believe the quote is they worried that it might prove to be systemically bad for the bank to have any sort of charges laid against them. What is going on here?
Well, you know, it's funny because my year in review, at some point I had to wrap it. And as you know, I had to get it a little earlier this year than we anticipated. And so on that particular point, I stated, I said, at the point that I uploaded it to you, I said that it is said that HSBC could be charged as much as $1.5 billion, which is peanuts for the kind of crime they committed. But also there could be criminal charges. And in the review, I said, yes, they could, but they won't. And about 2 days later, they said, by the way, there will be no criminal charges. And that's a class. I think HSBC actually inherited the BCCI clientele. I said that somewhat facetiously, but not totally. The BCCI collapse in the 90s released an awful lot of dark clients, you know, CIA, various intelligence agencies, the drug cartels, you name it. Anyone who wanted to do nefarious things with the banking system were there. It was a huge bank, and they went belly up, and they went somewhere, and I think they went to HSBC. Now they got caught.
Well, that could be, you know, the thing that's mysterious to me is every so often they will trot out pictures of cash and say, look, we found $25 million, but as you and I know, the actual global drug trade is over $1 trillion, and 99% of that gets laundered back through the banking system somehow. So the idea that too is vaporized or difficult to track or unknown is just, it's ridiculous to me. And so when finally something does happen where somebody gets cut, to me, caught HSBC in this case, the idea that no criminal charges are coming is actually another sort of a statement. It's the same statement. The reason I'm connecting this right here is that whereas John Corzine is doing things for very politically powerful people, in this case you mentioned the bundling of funds for Obama, HSBC too must have had some very powerful clientele within that roster of things. And so next thing you know, no charges get filed. Now, I understand this is kind of how the world works a little bit, but it's so pervasive, so in your face, so outrageous. I just feel this growing gap between what you and I as citizens are expected to comply with on a yearly basis and, you know, under penalties that are fairly swift and certain if we fail to, and what the institutions seem to be able to get away with. That gap, my perception, maybe I'm getting cranky in my older age, but that seems wider than it's ever been to me.
It's gotten so blatant that they don't seem to feel the need to hide it. And so, for example, I think a BCCI scandal broke now, nothing would happen. So there's a great example. So they got caught doing all the things that HSBC got caught doing, and that bank imploded because the curtain got pulled back too far and they couldn't put the scandal away. I think a lot of the things in the past that would that caused trouble would no longer cause trouble now because there's no penalty. The regulators, they're like, they're temporary regulators or something. They're just waiting for their job on Wall Street. So they've gotten no one. Right, they've convicted no one of anything that I can tell. I know of no instance.
Well, I think the one story that they've managed to get away with it, and they used it again with HSBC, is the too big to fail. That's their story. Like, oh, if we somehow collapsed HSBC, well, this would be systemically awful, and we're in such perilous times right now that we can't afford to even test that theory out. So therefore, we can't press criminal charges because somehow holding a few people responsible at a giant institution like HSBC would cause it to collapse or something. I'm not clear on what the storyline is, but it doesn't really hold water to me. It looks more like excuse making than a solid rationale by any decent measure.
Well, almost now they don't even say that. I'm not even hearing that. I'm just hearing that it goes away. So they've stopped even making fake excuses. It just goes away. They said we can't get Corzine, we can't get HSBC, we can't get these guys, and they don't give an explanation. And so this is some form of Stockholm syndrome where you start enabling your captors. And we as a populace are. I think at some point this all comes to a head. I think that these guys should be careful. They've decided the rule of law is not important. And if that's the case, then they might suffer the consequences of no rule of law. I think we're heading for a problem. We're going to have a showdown at some point, or we're heading for a much more closed society, a much more corrupt society.
Well, it's interesting. When I look at Greece's problems, for instance, corruption is just part of the Greek culture currently in their political system. And so guess what? People don't really feel obligated or like they have to pay taxes, and so their tax collections are really awful. There's a number of things that happen to me when you corrode not just the reality but also the appearance of rule of law where it's even and it's fair. I think that's one of three or four things that actually made or makes, depending on your point of view, the United States really fantastic place to be, is that there is contracts and contract law and rules and criminal penalties that are evenly applied. But that's falling apart. I want to paint this because I think this gives us an insight into what comes next.
I agree totally.
So let's talk about what comes next. So here we are in a system. Let's hold that thought aside about where our broken markets are sitting and the rule of law. I want to talk to you about resources for a minute because this is the other big dot I want to connect here. Water, oil, natural gas, coal, copper, tin, fish, land, all the rest. And they all seem to fall under one of two views, it seems, resources, that is. The dominant view is that supplies of them are never going to be either limited or limiting. The other view holds that the best non-renewable resources have already been stripped bare and we're down to lesser grades, while every renewable resource we can think of, land, water, fish, are obviously under human pressure. So as a couple of scientists here, I want to talk about resources because I think the dominant view is not just wrong, but dangerously wrong. And so let's start with the most critical, oil. There's been a magnificent campaign lately to convince us that there's so much still to be had, there's really nothing to worry about. What are your thoughts there?
Well, the fracking has produced a perception of a game change, and some really smart guys buy the model, and I'm agnostic in the medium term, and that is to say, I think it bought us some time. But I saw a report that came out that said that we will be producing something like 20.1 million barrels of oil a day in the year 2028, some ridiculous thing, and it was a three decimal point estimate of our production. I'm thinking, however, that's an idiot, right? Mm-hmm. You can't estimate something like that to three decimal points, but it goes nuts. I mean, everyone trumpets the numbers. That's the kind of propaganda you get. I saw an estimate out there that said that in 2028, Saudi Arabia would become an importer of oil. And And I'm reading this, I'm thinking, who are they going to import from? Right? The journalist didn't ask that question. They're going to import from what? Mars? This is a silly concept. So they don't take it to the next step. The journalists are not very discriminating, in my opinion, and they don't scratch their heads and go into uncomfortable places that you have to sometimes go, you know, and ask uncomfortable questions. So, yeah, I think resource depletion is a killer. Jeremy Grantham's out there saying this. There's a lot of people who are. We'll eventually be told when it starts to become a problem that no one saw it coming, and of course they did. But, yeah, I totally agree, and to varying degrees depending on the resource. The one thing I did point out in my review was I got to talk to the CEO of Chemetall, and he says the rare earths are not rare. He said that particular fear of running out in the soon, the idea that China has them all, he says that's not correct. He says China dominates the market because they undercut everybody. So there's a bright news. But, you know, we're going to run out of helium here. The helium shortage is a big one. People don't know why that's important, but it's profoundly important.
Oh, it's extraordinarily important. Helium, and in particular, one isotope, helium-3, extremely important in medical imaging technology, neutron detection, other things like that.
Well, also as a coolant, though. You use vast quantities of helium for a number of these MRI imaging devices.
Right.
And so, you know, we could find out that we used up all the helium that would have allowed us to get, you know, scans of our knees. We used them in party balloons, right? That would be that'll be a silly realization when we get to there.
Right. Well, let me turn back to oil for a second, because there's been something that's been driving me a little bit nuts for a while. It started in February of 2012, I believe, is where my first instant I started tracking it. And that's where this idea of energy independence came along. And that was the first confusion in this story, because they started talking about the United States in terms of energy independence. And of course, forms of energy are not interchangeable. If you're in a lab, your Bunsen burner gives you a very different sort of thing that you can do with it than the electricity that's in the wall switch or anything else. So energy independence is one thing, but really it's the liquid fuel story that's the most important one. So I saw that first clouding. And then the second thing was they started lumping all kinds of things in terms of barrel of oil equivalents as if they were truly equivalent. Natural plant gas liquids, which nobody can put in their gas tank yet. Other things like that are just not actually oil. So when we peel all that fluff away and we actually ask the question, where are we in the oil story? For whatever reason, as I'm talking to you today, Brent is 109 a barrel, WTIC is 90 a barrel, and when we look at this, those numbers are not consistent with a world awash in oil, given where we are in the macroeconomic story. And so there's something here that I'm finding a larger and larger disconnect between what we're being told about the energy story and what the actual data is telling me. It's a fairly profound gap right now. Both price information and volume information. Those two things are out of line with the official narrative. What are your thoughts? Why is that happening?
Well, you know, that crisscrosses a number of troublesome factors. One is that the commodity markets, and this I have trouble getting my brain around, but the commodity markets, the pricing is being set by the futures market. And so somehow it appears, and again, the commodity guys all understand this. I don't, but somehow the guys trading paper get to set the price of the guys actually trading the hard commodity or the soft commodity. And at some point, if the paper traders take the markets to some place where the actual supply of the commodity can't go, then we're going to have this gigantic disconnect. That's the first thing. The other thing is that if you actually look at the price of oil, people say, well, you know, there's no inflation in this world that we've lived in for the last, you know, couple of decades. They rant about the inflation being tame for so long, and you know about shadowstats.com and how John Williams calculates inflation a different way. I like to use college tuition as an inflation measure.
Mm-hmm.
Oil, since the late 90s, has gone up tenfold. And so here are these guys saying inflation's tame, but the energy that fuels the planet has gone up tenfold. That causes a serious brain cramp for me. So I think the oil is telling us something about the inflation numbers, too. So you know much more about this whole commodity sector than me, so you should keep talking.
Well, it's... you know, it's when we look at the total basket of commodities, it's up close to tenfold as well over the last maybe 10 or 12 years. It's up extraordinarily, right? And so for the rest of the world that's A, pricing things in dollars because of the nature of the world commodity exchange, and B, where their local populace has to spend upwards of 50% of their total income on food and fuel, they're not experiencing anything close to what we might be, you know, the United States is busy telling the world there's no inflation, but I'll guarantee you approximately 3/4 of the world's population isn't experiencing it that way. They're experiencing it quite differently.
That's true. And I think the inflation-deflation debate reaches levels of absurdity when you realize that when you realize that something so complex as inflation and deflation, which I find has an asymmetry to it already. I can understand inflation better than I can understand deflation. I'm not sure why. But the whole debate to talk about something so complex using a binary language is just nuts, right? This is like saying, is it sunny or raining? And there's a lot of other choices out there.
Right.
So I think we're going to have, you know, things that matter to us getting expensive and Beanie Babies getting cheaper, and they'll declare that Beanie Babies are the best inflation measure and declare inflation tame.
Absolutely. Well, my final point on resources is that the non-renewable resource sector, which I track carefully looking at things like grain prices and land availability and water and aquifers and things like that, it's just so clear to me that we're under tremendous pressure already at 7 billion. As we head to 9, 9.5, maybe 10 billion people by the end of the century, clearly those pressures are just going to increase. Has this factored into your investment strategies at all and you personally?
Oh, big time. So as you know, my portfolio has not been a standard, you know, balanced 60-40 stock bond portfolio since
right.
about 1999. And I went totally into hard assets, first exiting every mutual fund. Second, by the middle of 99, I'd started buying lots of gold and silver. But 2001 is when I started investing in energy, and it started out as an inflation hedge, and then I started running into these odd articles about peak oil, and I had to dig into those, and I started hearing about how Gawar is you know, the Saudi's biggest field is gasping, and I ran into the whole Matt Simmons story, and Colin, what's his name? Colin, come on, give it to me, Chris.
In Campbell.
Any event.
Colin
yeah.
Campbell.
Yeah, Colin Campbell. Sorry, Colin. And I realized that oil and energy were more than an inflation hedge. And at the same time, the reason I like those investments is because if for some reason you and I are nuts, we're a couple of monkeys with our brains in a bell jar and they're tweaking us, and the world's actually rather normal uh-huh. for everyone else, energy ought to do well then too. And so it's my way of attempting to be normal and hedge against inflation, hedge against risk. The one thing I do not like being is long the dollar, which is what cash is. So I've attempted to invest in things that hurt when you drop them on your foot.
I like that. That's solid resources, tangible. I like all of that. Look, before we get to that dollar story, which I do want to get to, before you mentioned you like to follow shadow stats for inflation, I got to tie this back to something that I think you pointed to in your year-end review, which is that right around the election, it turns out that these fuzzy numbers that are being presented to us, the employment numbers or unemployment numbers, housing, inflation, GDP growth, all those things, I found those to be absolutely bizarre the closer we got to the election. What was your perception there?
Well, you know, so the numbers coming out of federal agencies, I think, are suspect at all times. I think that they're politically motivated. I talk about the birth-death model. So here's a model in which supposedly there are jobs that you cannot detect. And I can buy that model. But then they say, well, therefore we have to figure out how many there are. And you go, well, but you can't detect them, so how do you figure that out? So they start fabricating, best I can tell. And the birth-death adjustment now is so substantial, it's so politically motivated, that in some months the birth-death correction is substantially bigger than the job counts themselves. And so here they're fabricating fictitious numbers. They never, during the depths of the recession, the birth-death model never said there are jobs disappearing appearing that we can't detect. And so there's a highly cooked number. And so then I think the one you're referring to is right before the election, unemployment dropped by 0.4%, which
yeah.
In units of employment, that is a cliff in itself. That's a free fall. That thing sponsored by Red Bull. That plummet. And you know, the visceral response by everyone immediately was, these numbers are just wrong. But then it turned into this political football, and you got Jack Welch getting into this big brawl over his tweet in which he said that Chicago boys cooked the numbers, and so it's clear that you not only can't believe the numbers in the most general sense, because they cook them for political reasons, but during an election year when everything's at stake, you can't believe them is squared. They're corrupted to the point of it's so. In my opinion, the election clouded 2012 so much that it was difficult to tease out the truth, even relative to other years.
And still, there's this crazy thing that happens where the market buys the number, whatever it happens to be, upon its release, but then with the inevitable downward revision in prior periods, somehow it just doesn't respond to that. So is this just a Pavlovian market response, or what's going on?
It's an Escher diagram. the guy keeps running around. And so so Zero Hedge has been all over this, where they say, look, it's a three-step process. You announce great numbers. In the quiet of some later moment, you say, by the way, those numbers are adjusted down. And then you report the next numbers, and you say these numbers are fantastic compared to the downwardly revised numbers. And so it's this constant game, and for the markets respond in a way that I think Bill Fleckenstein used to say at the best. He says the guessers are guessing what the other guessers are guessing. And so it just becomes absurd. It makes no sense. It's a bunch of computer algos chasing news reports, and it's just, the noise is huge now.
Well, we have the price of everything, maybe the value of nothing. I spent some really valuable time talking with Eric Hunsader of Nanex, and that's an exchange information outfit. And what they do is they have access to all this exchange information down to millisecond resolution. And when I wanted to understand certain things that happened, like why oil suddenly plunged $4 in 2 minutes, or why gold, you know, had 3,000 contracts dumped at 8:40 in the morning, or things like that, I have to run over to Eric, and then he shows me the data. And what's happening now is that you have to see this at the millisecond execution time frame now, and an entity will come in and just, we can't tell which ones from the data because that's obscured, but you can tell it is an entity just dumping massive contracts, clearly only to move price. That's why you do something like that. It's not because you're a sophisticated investor. So two things came out to me around that. One is, these are obvious price manipulations, and those are being just left uninvestigated. And that has important long-term implications, because price discovery is now, I submit to you, broken. The thing that really sort of gets me around these is that it looks like just the tiniest amount of money can move giant markets now, because what you'll do, because all these computers are out battling with each other, it's like battle bots, you know, or there's an arena and they're all in there, and all somebody has to do is you know, toss something warm and fuzzy in there, and they're all over it. And so it appeared to, I asked him, like, how much did it take for this line in the S&P E-minis, how much did it take for that to be defended? It was coming at a critical support juncture. All of a sudden, it reversed the other direction. He's like, oh, somebody bought 30,000 contracts. You know, has a notional value of quite a bit of money, but the actual amount, a few tens of millions of dollars. That's it.
And seconds later, if not fractions of seconds later, they can get rid of them. So the exposure to tens of millions is on this unbelievably short time scale. And so, but this is a metastable system, right? As a scientist, you know this. You get these complex systems with these feedback loops. Anyone who thinks that we're not going to have a catastrophic market seizure at some point going forward, not just in the past, is nuts, right? This is a system that has the most spectacular feedback loops I've ever seen. And so, you know, what the world, for example, doesn't know. By the way, these guys at Nanex, these guys are treasures. Eric, and, you know, one time I saw something odd, I send it to Saluzzi, he sends it to Eric, I get the answer back. It's so fantastic that these guys can watch this. But, you know, Berkshire Hathaway at $120,000 a share flash crashed to $1. Right? And it doesn't even make it to CNBC because they're too busy sniffing around, you know, Warren Buffett for nuggets of wisdom from this guy who's the biggest stock jobber I've ever seen. Buffett drives me completely nuts because he's a total insider, and he trades on inside information, and at the same time he's got this little old man thing. He's like the mafia don walking around in his bathrobe, right? Looking
yeah.
innocuous. So, sorry, I went on a rant. He drives me crazy.
Well, that's all right. But I'm really interested in this phenomenon now where essentially, here's my perception. The markets have all this fuel being dumped into them, $85 billion a month, courtesy of the Fed. That fuel finds its way into the markets. So the markets
are... Not to mention other central banks. That's just us.
Yeah, like, I know.
There's more central banks out there doing it.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Just,
go ahead.
Lots of fuel. And that's on one side of the equation. On the other side... Like the real slow burn rocket fuel for any market needs to be widespread participation, meaning you have a productive class of people out there who are busy producing real things, and in the consequence of doing that, they earn income and they have some left over for savings, and then that flows into the markets, and that's a fairly virtuous route where, you know, you have productivity and value creation and real productive enterprise. I love that cycle, right? So you can see how that one will work, but retail participation has been like negative for how long now? They don't even talk about it. I have to hunt for the information now. It's been 30, 40 months. I don't even know anymore.
But it's deeper than retail participation. We've now, it comes down to demographics, right? So back in the 90s, they kept saying, oh, you know, these markets are going to soar because the boomers are going to just put more and more in. And no one really thought about the fact that boomers would start going conservative before they actually retired. You can't go into retirement carrying Dell and WorldCom and then get out of it later. You've got to start downsizing, and so the boomers are downsizing. They're downsizing everything. They're at some point they're going to sell their McMansions. They're going to sell their equities. They're already selling their equities. They're not going back because they can't afford to. And so this idea that retail somehow has got to come back. The average person has no savings. Their income has been pounded. There is no return trip for these people. The average boomer has got something like $70,000 in savings. This is crazy.
And even if they were to sell their McMansion or their portfolio, to whom would they sell it?
Our kids, and they're making nothing. They got student loans. They've got so in the olden days, you know, if you go into some small burb, some burg, you know, like Ithaca, where I'm at, you go downtown, you see these big Victorian mansions, and they are not single owner occupied, and what they are is they're funeral homes, they're multi-resident dwellings, they're all these things, right? So they've converted them to something useful. I presume those things were built during a heyday. When there was a pile of people who had money and they said, let's build a big house, and then they discovered we can't afford a big house, right? So now we did the same thing again, but there's a difference. Our McMansions are spread all over the countryside. So they're not downtown where they can be converted to Victorian stores or McMansion things. They're out in the hills. And there is no one who's going to be able to buy them unless you and I are dead wrong and there's some big boom coming and our kids are just going to be stinking rich and they're going to want to buy a house with 5,000 square feet that costs a fortune to re-roof, that costs a fortune to heat, that, by the way, is also going to depreciate at a rate that's unimaginable because they're made like garbage.
It's, yeah, the greatest story never told is that houses are not assets that appreciate. They are depreciation machines.
They're liabilities.
They are liabilities. You feed them money and capital and effort and all of that. And yes, so listen, there's another big story that comes in here that's still not even remotely talked about enough. And this is the idea that Ben Bernanke, following in Alan Greenspan's footsteps, decided that the infinite wisdom is we're just going to fix things by running interest rates down to 0% for as long as necessary. I think we're committed through 2015 now, or no, wait, forever. Isn't that right? Because we have to wait for unemployment to hit a certain rate it may never hit. So potentially forever. And against that backdrop, we have all of these people who are retiring who should have had money parked in something safe, right? Navigating away from the Dells and the Microsofts and all that into some other form of safe bonds or money market funds or something where they're earning some rate of interest that at least approximates inflation. Because you and I know inflation is not zero. It's higher than that. So he's saddled us with negative real returns. Now, what are we, 4 years into that experiment? If you are a pension fund, if you are an endowment, if you are somebody with actuarial liabilities, if you are in any way responsible for an entitlement program with investments on the back end of it, this is negative compounding for 4 years now, going on five. That's a hole I think can't be climbed out of at this point because of what Bernanke has done. He has ruined saving and he has ruined actuarial sort of investments. So, well, first of all, your thoughts on that?
Well, so if you look at what happened to people's nest eggs during the 07 to 09 calamity, which, by the way, I don't think is the last one, as you, I'm sure you agree, but while their equities were getting pounded and their houses were getting pounded, the people who were 60-40, which is most people, right, even if they didn't know it, because most people had their money in some sort of pension fund or something, you know, they're 60-40. Let's call it 50-50 to keep the math easy. It wasn't 50-50, but let's call it 50-50 to keep the math easy. While the equities were getting clobbered, the bonds were rocking, right? The bonds were mm-hmm. soaring because they drove interest rates down, and so it provided this buffer. Mm-hmm. So on the way, as equities got beaten up and bonds soared, it produced a bit of a wash. You know, some people weren't hurt, but their bond funds just were spectacular. So here we're at, and it's 2013, and now you've got this ugly case scenario where, in the best possible scenario, interest rates stay low forever, right? Mm-hmm. Not going to happen, but let's pretend like it is. If that's true, then that means half of their portfolio will return zero, mm-hmm. right? They're getting nothing. They're getting, what is it, a couple of percent for a 10-year bond. And as a consequence, it means, therefore, that they're going to have to get all their returns on equities, and it's not going to happen. And there's this folklore out there that says equities go up when rates are low. That's wrong. Equities go up when rates are dropping. Warren Buffett said that in 1999, and it's clear. Dropping interest rates, rising equities. It's a PE interest rate relationship. Mm-hmm. Once they're low, the profit squeezed out. It's gone. So now the more logical scenario is rates rise against Bernanke's will. And what would happen? What would cause that? Well, that would be inflation shows up, and you just no longer can keep them low. You end up in some high inflation, runaway inflation scenario. Now you're going to lose principal. Now your bond fund is going to get annihilated. You're also going to, the equities are going to get annihilated, because who's going to pay for a dividend of 2% when inflation's running high? And so the equities get pounded when interest rates are rising. And as a consequence, you're going to have dropping equity prices. You're going to have dropping bond fund principal. You're going to have no slack. We've squeezed the slack out. And Bernanke, I don't know if he gets this or not. He's a smart guy, but he's also, in my opinion, a fool. And you can be both.
Well, so I think it's a great point you make. It's not low interest rates that support a rising equity market. It's falling rates that support a rising equity market. And then, of course, the reverse is true. Rates rise, equities fall. So that's the world that, you know, that potential energy has now been stored in the system. There it is. I want to talk now about gold and silver against that backdrop, that context there, because, and I mentioned also, you don't like the dollar. So this is all going to hopefully come together into one conversation here. So gold and silver, a tough end to a kind of a lackluster year, first out of maybe 11 or so where that's been true. Let's talk about the precious metal markets first, and then maybe what the fundamentals are for the metal. So markets, what do you see when you look at the gold and silver markets?
Well, they've been flopping around in a way that's pretty standard for a secular bull market. If you look at the previous bull market, there were periods where the metal investors got beaten up pretty good en route to some spectacular returns. And so none of this troubles me. It's clear to me at this point that the case for intentional intervention in the precious metals market is not a bad case. I don't know if I sign off on it, but I think that those who say, look, powerful forces are getting in there and messing around with the metal price. It is undeniable now, thanks to Rob Kirby, who came up with a document from the Comptroller of the Currency showing that J.P. Morgan has a short position in silver. We know they have a short position in silver. We know that Blythe Masters claimed that they were hedging. Well, if so, it turns out their short position silver is equivalent to 50% of the entire global bullion supply. And so I think Blythe is fibbing a little bit there. They've got some serious speculation going on. And at some point, does the price get out of the corral that they've put it in? That would be my bet. And I also, as long as central bankers are printing, how can you not like the metals? It's hard for me to imagine that. And the other thing is, they said it was a bubble. Well, it's not acting like a post-bubble period either. When you really hit a bubble, take a look at Qualcomm or some stock like that. After that bubble popped, it was a free fall. It went straight down.
This bubble talk always gets under my skin a little. So I need let's name one other bubble where you had broad participation that you had to measure in the single percent range.
That's a great point. So it's estimated that the percentage of the investing world of the metals is in the ballpark of a percent. I've seen below a percent, but it's in the ballpark of a percent. So if you take all the portfolios around the world and you say, what percentage is metals? It's around 1%. And historically, it's supposed to be around 5. So that's a fivefold gain in front of you. Just get back to historical norms. And then you have central banks are now net buyers, right? This is the smartest money on the planet. These are not day traders. These central banks are not buying and intending to flip it like, you know, flipping condos or anything. And China, which everyone knows is a financial juggernaut, they're buying gold and they're buying silver. Their gold position is something like 2% of their reserves. So they could ramp that to 50, and it would do unbelievable things to the price discovery mechanism of gold. And so, it's hard to be pessimistic. So I admit it's painful watching the metals get bashed back and forth, and the metal equities getting bashed back and forth. But you and I, you know, we bought the metals back when they were in the 200s, and so it's painful, but it's not that painful.
Well, to get to the markets really quickly, of course, no, not painful. I'm just very patient like you. I know the day will come, and I've really stopped paying hour to hour, day to day sort of attention to the prices, because it's not really relevant unless I'm thinking of adding more, and then I'll trot out some charts and look at them and think about when I want to put some more into my portfolio. But the markets themselves, so I did track, using Eric over at Nanex, some of these, there were some raids that happened recently in both gold and silver where you would see thousands and thousands of contracts dumped in a single, 80 millisecond period. And again, that has nothing to do with normal price discovery. That's a price manipulation moment. Nobody is doing that to suddenly, balance their portfolio or liquidate something, as they commonly like to trot out. Like that rumor that maybe Paulson, one of the most sophisticated hedge fund operators in the world, just one day just like pushes a sell button and unloads his gold position, like a complete novice. Not true. So I look at that, but I've seen that same behavior in many other markets and in equities markets. I've seen it in the oil markets. It's somebody out there is able to push price around to their benefit. So Key Bono, well, if you wanted the price to go down, these to me aren't two very hard dots to connect. If I happen to own the largest short position in silver, I might be the first institution I would go looking at if I was an investigator to say, who pushed that massive sell button right at that moment in time? So those, and without the investigation, we won't know, and I don't have to get into theories about why they're doing it, or are they doing it because the central banks want them to, or any of that stuff. I can just say that looking at the market structure with shorts that are that outsized, in fact, those are by definition manipulative when you hold that concentrated a position in a futures position in market. And on the other hand, we see these things come through, which are clearly price manipulation events. How can these two dots not be connected? It leaves fertile territory for average inquiring, somewhat intelligent people to go, there's some smoke there. Can we please investigate and assure me that there's no fire? And of course, the CFTC refuses to really do that in anything like a meaningful way.
So, yes, at one point, there were 75,000 sell orders in silver in 1 second, right? That's That's not an investor. That's something altogether different. That's a cheetah trader doing that one. This is why the Nanox guys are so important, because they show us this, right? They look in these short time scales. They can see the monkey hammering going on in these markets. Now, there still are two levels, though. One possible level is that the markets are just have been discovered, that the precious metal markets have been discovered by the HFTs, and then what looks like manipulation is really just algos banging away at the problem and just pounding away, and they're finding air pockets, and they're drilling down the prices and making money going down and then making money going up. And the other is that there's a more intended purpose behind it, and the former certainly happening. The algos have got a hold of the precious metal markets now in a serious way. The latter, certainly the GATA guys would say that it's the intention is price suppression. I make a case for price suppression in my review, where I point out that you know, for example, gold leasing, right? The central banks lease gold to traders. Why would you ever lease gold? And you say, well, that they can rent it, right? This is a profit, but the lease rates are something like 0.2%. So there's no profit motive there. That's free capital in the very least, and it also, you lease out the gold, they sell it, then it's going to drop the price. But it also means that the central banks don't have the gold. It's out there now, it's been sold. And it's suspicious that our central banks report gold as both the leased gold and the gold supposedly in possession are reported as a single line item. So they actually don't dissect those two. And so they pretend like leased gold is as good as gold, as one might say. And it's not. It's gone. So
that's a great point, too. And I have this conversation from time to time where the things that I know that my central bank openly admits to manipulating, and by the way, the one that's the most important that just drives me the craziest is they manipulate the price of money. And when you do that, every other price, by definition, becomes distorted or manipulated, depending on which verbiage you're more comfortable with.
And it renders our money worthless. That's the key, is because our capital in the olden days used to have value. We'd work, we'd save, and then someone would come along and say, you know, if you lend me the money that you've saved, I'll pay you for it, and I'll find a productive use for it. And therefore, you would get a return. And now the central banks have decided that they will render our hard-earned capital worthless. And it is worthless at this point. It returns nothing.
They've distorted the time value of money, which is one of the biggest distortions out there. And of course, $85 billion a month. That's my number one fundamental statistic. You know, we're building up this pressure across the world where we're just throwing more and more and more money in. We, the central banks, have some crazy idea. They're running an social experiment, the largest one ever, with an N of one. It's got a binary outcome. It works or it fails. And this feels a little risky to me, because this same experiment has been run on a micro scale hundreds of times throughout history, and it's never worked. So they've never come forward and said, this time when we're going to run this grand printing experiment, printing our way to prosperity, here's why we think it's going to work this time. Right? They've never had that actual explicit conversation, you know, come out. Ron Paul used to bang at Bernanke with questions kind of like that, and Bernanke would just dodge, and then nobody would follow up, and that was the end of it. But here we are. I think this is the thing that's, you know, when I look at your year-end review and I think about where we are, if 5 years ago or 10 years ago, you had just picked me up and dropped me into this moment and showed me what the central banks were up to, I would have just gotten up out of my chair with my hair on fire and run outside, you know. And I just want to back up. All of our baselines have been shifted. You know, it's been creeping up. We get assaulted with this news constantly. You know, the Federal Reserve's doing more and more and more, and the other central banks. But just stop. Time out. Back up. This is insane.
Well, do you remember, so when they bailed out the system by basically dropping $30 billion into Bear Stearns? I mean, you could taste vomit in your mouth when you read that article, because, oh my God, they just dumped $30 billion into Bear Stearns? You're kidding me. That's such a quaint number now.
I know.
They've desensitized us to the point where they go on TV, they not only talk about numbers in the trillions, but they actually get people in the system cheering for it. This is going to be historically bizarre. There's going to be people looking back and saying, "Explain this to me again. Why you guys thought the system was okay?" because it looks insane retrospectively. And it, prospectively, it would look insane, too. If you took some person from 1950 and beamed them forward, they'd go, you guys are nuts. This doesn't work.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So let me, final question here. You've managed a very impressive 11% average compounded annual rate of growth for, what's that now, 10 years or more?
13. Well, and I, before 13, I just used January 1st of 2000 because that really, to me, that's the one I cite because that's the one when everyone else started to suffer, right?
Yep.
And so if you go back, it worked fine too, but everyone was fine. As of January 1st of 2000, I've averaged 11% compounded, admittedly with 2 years in a row that are essentially break even.
So here's the question around that, because that's very impressive. We just had a long conversation here, and you have it in the year-end review, around how broken and dysfunctional our markets really are, and that money is mispriced, and this is insane. So what is the poor, confused investor to do if you were to pass on some sage advice? How do we navigate these next few years here?
Yes. Well, someone who has money, this is a nasty problem. This really is a... You know, so you and I, we like metals, we like energy, we think, you know, if you've got to go somewhere, those, but they can be hurt, too. It's not like we're sitting around going, there's no way these things aren't going to get whacked, because
right.
We know they can be whacked. We just think it's the best bet we've got. I have no optimum bets. I wish I could think of something that was safe, but there's nothing safe now. We're in the middle of a mess. My advice, first and foremost, is don't underestimate what it costs to retire. You will be told by the authorities what it takes to retire, and those estimates are way, way off. Fidelity's saying you need 8 times your annual salary to retire, and if you do the math, that'll get you about 10 years worth of retirement, and then you're done.
Mm-hmm.
You need more like 20 or 25, and I guarantee you your listeners are very unlikely to be on track to get 20 or 25 multiples of their annual salary in the bank before they retire. And your listeners are all boomers, so these are scary, scary numbers. And I just say hang on as long as you can. Don't retire. Don't retire if you don't have to. Don't retire thinking you're going to get a part-time job, because it's going to be at a drive-through window if you do.
And how about the importance of living frugally? Does that factor in?
It certainly does. For one thing, the more frugally you live, the less you need to retire. So,
absolutely.
So, and the more you save. So it's a twofer. If you could live off half your salary, you not only would therefore need a lot less, but you'd have a lot more. Unfortunately for a lot of people, we're past the fail-safe point. I hate to bring that news, but someone who's 60 years old, who's way behind the eight ball, and this is a very large percentage of the population, I don't see a mathematical solution beyond just austere old age.
Mm.
It's a consequence. It's not a cause. You know, Europe is a consequence. Austerity in Greece, you know, they say, oh, we decided to do austerity in Greece. No, Greece is a pathetically dysfunctional country with no efficiency, no prosperity, no nothing. That's not a choice. That's a consequence, and we're going to suffer the same, in my opinion.
Well, the alternative is that we're going to be allowed to live beyond our means forever, and history is not
that'll happen.
Really supportive of that as a awesome strategy. So, maybe
hope is not a strategy, as they say.
Absolutely not. And yet, there is still a lot of hope in this story for me because we can shape our lives, we can take control of our finances. I recommend very strongly that everybody listening, the first thing, the best investments you can make are in yourself. My best investments this past year were a solar hot water system, insulation, both of which are going to have triple-digit returns in the first case, high double-digit returns in the second case, because I'm investing in myself in ways that minimize my future cash flows. Put it in a spreadsheet, it just makes perfect sense. We've been captured in a lot of cases by the idea that investing means taking your money, closing your eyes, sending it to Wall Street, crossing your fingers and hoping. And there's many, many better ways, I think, now to get involved with investing, which begins right at home. And it's all around the idea of minimizing future cash flows out the door rather than trying to maximize future cash flows in the door. Little flip, but it's actually a story that I can make perfect sense of, get my arms around, and there's no risk in it unless oil goes to $0 a barrel.
So I did have this one idea, and that is that people talk about, especially people of you know, like you, and that is to invest locally. And so I have this image of investing, you know, in local businesses. And so you pool resources and then you invest in things that you can go kick the tire. And then I piece this whole model together. I go, you know what we'll call it a savings and loan. So,
it's a great idea.
Give the money to HSBC unless you want to support drug cartels. Then you should.
Then you should. Well, with that, Dave, it's been my pleasure as always. We're going to have to do this much more frequently than biannually. So, listen, thank you so much for your time and for the year-end review.
I appreciate you letting me do it.